This is Jim Inkster coming today on the show. This is the 50th anniversary of the first fight between Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston. Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali immediately after the fight, and the legend of Ali grew and grew and grew, but it all began on this night, February 25th, 1964, in Miami Beach, Florida, when Ali defied the odds and defeated Charles Sonny Liston for the heavyweight championship of the world. We'll talk with sports writer Mark Cram, the son of Mark Cram Sr., who was the primary writer of Muhammad Ali's career in its heyday. Also, Jason Berry, the Louisiana writer who's been a major reporter on scandals in the Catholic Church. He's back with a Frontline documentary tonight, Secrets of the Vatican. Now the news. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Our guest to begin is Mark Cram, Jr., the author of Like Any Normal Day, awarded the 2013 Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing. It's now available in paperback, and Mark Cram, Jr. is the son of the late Mark Cram, who covered Muhammad Ali for Sports Illustrated between 1963 and 1977, and was the author of the controversial 2001 book Ghosts of Manila, The Fateful Blood Feud Between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. It was on this date in 1964, 16 days after the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show, that Muhammad Ali became a household word in America. He won the heavyweight championship over Charles Sonny Liston. He was a 7-1 underdog against the seemingly invincible champion. And he changed his name, announced to the world he was a Muslim, and he changed the world along the way. And the man who covered him closer than anybody else was Mark Cram Sr. And Mark Cram Jr., it's good to talk with you once again.
It's nice to talk to you, Jim.
Well, your dad knew Ali very well, and unlike Norman Mailer, who knew Ali very well, your dad had a mixed view of the man. Ali was a man with great strengths and weaknesses. But on this night in 1964, he truly defied the world. I think 93% of the sports writers who were covering the event thought that Sonny Liston would win and that Sonny would keep his promise to knock Ali out by the second round.
Well, it was the thinking was that Ali, or as many of the sports writers persisted to call him Clay, that he didn't have a chance against Sonny. Sonny, a little background, he had grown up on a sharecropper's family in Arkansas, one of 25 children. His father had had 12 children with his first wife and 13 with his second wife. And he used to subject Sonny to some fierce whippings. And eventually Sonny migrated to St. Louis with his mother when he was about 13, and became involved in street muggings and various other crimes. He became known as the Yellow Shirt Bandit. And really, he was involved in some violent robberies. He was sentenced to Missouri State Penitentiary for 5 years, and it was there he really learned to box. That's sort of how he sort of emerged as this figure when he got out of prison in 1953. I mean, he turned to the ring and was very much involved with the mob. The mob more or less underwrote his boxing career at that point, and, you know, through his career. So he was a despised figure in America at that time. But Ali, by virtue of the fact that he joined the Nation of Muslims, was an even more despised figure, if you can believe that. So oddly, Sonny had become sort of the establishment choice, right? Which Sonny totally rejected. But the point is that there was no thought in anyone's mind that the young upstart Ali could even lay a glove on Liston, and we know that was clearly wrong.
Clearly wrong, and Liston came into this fight as an invincible warrior, seemingly so.
7-1 favorite.
Right, and he had knocked out Floyd Patterson, the previous champion, twice in the first round in two heavyweight championship fights. And many thought Ali was destined for the same fate as Patterson.
He was unbeatable. He was thought to be unbeatable. They called him the Big Bear. And oddly enough, when they two met in the center of the ring for the instructions, Ali towered over him. So I think that came to a shock to some writers, the fact that, you know, while Liston was this physical, muscular force, Ali was bigger, he was faster, and it soon became clear in the early rounds that he could hit Liston with relative ease. He opened a cut on Liston's face in the third round, and the fight was really going Ali's way very early, and Liston just didn't seem to know what to do with him. I wish I'd have had some of that 7-1 money on the underdog.
Well, Liston, as you say, was not as tall as Ali. He was 6'1", Ali 6'3", but Liston had 84-inch reach, the reach for a 7-footer, and he was a powerfully built man, and he hit harder than probably anybody else in the fight game then or now. But before the fight, Ali, all of 22 years old and barely 22, was talking a good game. He was obviously hyping the fight, but at the same time, he was inflaming Liston with remarks like these.
Clay comes out to meet Liston, and Liston starts to retreat. If Liston goes back an inch farther, he'll end up in a ringside seat. Clay swings with a left. Clay swings with a right. Look at young Cassius carry the fight. Liston keeps backing, but there's not enough room. It's a matter of time. And Clay lowers the boom. Now Clay lands with a right. What a beautiful swing. And the punch raises the bear clear out of the ring. Yes, the crowd did not dream when they laid down their money that they would see a total eclipse of the sunny.
Interesting that he was still calling himself Clay at that point.
Yeah. Well, it's I'm sure one of Bundini Brown or someone wrote that for him. You know, that was partly funny, but also it really spoke to sort of the fear that Clay had for, or Ali had for Liston. I mean, don't kid yourself. He had he was frightened of Liston, like everyone else was. But the point is that Ali would have had this weird way during his whole career of kind of transforming that fear into a positive energy. And Dad always thought that it was, the fear was a great motivator with Ali throughout his career.
And he did almost identically the same thing a decade later, beating the then-invincible George Foreman in a fight in which, once again, Ali was the underdog. But the whole Ali legend would never have been without the victory over Sonny Liston on this night in Miami, Florida.
Well, it was his public coming out in many, obviously. The fight was in jeopardy at one point, the first fight in Miami. You know, Ali got some liniment or some resin in his eyes in the fourth round and wanted to quit, basically, in his quarter. He couldn't see. He was staggering around. And it was only by virtue of the fact that Angelo Dundee, his trainer, you know, more or less hurled him into the center of the ring to begin round five. At that point, Ali's eyes cleared, and he started hitting Liston at will again. Strangely enough, you know, Liston did not come out for the seventh round. He quit on his stool, which was an extraordinary event, actually, because Liston had fought an entire fight once with a broken jaw. But Liston was very much spooked by the Muslims, you know, that were that attached themselves to Ali. And he, you know, they very much gave him a very much of an a feeling of dread. So a lot of things, I think, conspired to keep him in his corner in the seventh round. But by doing so, he kind of deprived Ali of his big moment in the ring, you know, that this was, you know, he wanted to thoroughly destroy Liston. And so Sonny sort of took that from him. And he did it again in Lewiston, Maine, in their rematch. He, according to my father, Sonny told him that he threw the fight. He sat down in the first round and was hit with a relatively light punch. And just we've all seen the famous Neil Leifer photograph of Ali standing over, the conquering Ali standing over Liston, who sprawled on the canvas. Basically, depriving Ali of his big moment. So, you know, the first part of Ali's career before his exile from the ring for not submitting to the draft, it's kind of a mixed review in many ways. You know, I mean, he had all this remarkable talent, but had it shown itself in the ring yet? You know, I mean, to its fullest extent, in the big championship moment, there was some the question whether it had.
Well, on this night, he left the ring saying, "I am the greatest," and he kept saying that for about 13, 14 years. And when he retired the next to the last time in 1978, after beating Leon Spinks to win the championship in the Superdome, mm-hmm. he was 36 years old. But your dad wrote about the fight in 1975. We're coming up on 39 years this year between the third fight between Muhammad Ali, who was 33, Joe Frazier, who was 31. Ali was the champion. He had defeated George Foreman. It was thought that Frazier was washed up, and it turned into probably the greatest heavyweight fight of all time in Manila. Oppressive heat. And the two men battered each other for 14 rounds. And that fight took much out of both of them, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yes. If you go back and read my father's piece that he had written for Sports Illustrated on that fight, it's considered one of the greatest sports stories really ever written. You really get a sense of the toll that it took on both of the fighters. It was nonstop action. 15 rounds in the tropical heat, and the only reason that Ali prevailed in the end was by virtue of the fact that he was a bigger, stronger, physically dominant man. It was a question of size and over Frazier. He had the physical advantage over Joe. And Joe desperately wanted to come out for the 15th round, but he was stopped by his trainer, Eddie Futch, who really thought that Joe would put himself really in harm's way if he came out for the final round. He couldn't see out of his eyes. He couldn't see the punches coming at him. It was, you know, Eddie saved him from perhaps a fatal end by doing that. But the fight was, you know, maybe one of the greatest of all time. Two heavyweights, really at the top of their gifts. You know, both of them should have retired after that fight, but neither did. And in Ali's case, it was he was in for a long, sad denouement.
Ali is now 72 years old. He's hanging in just like he did as a fighter. Nobody ever knocked him out cold, and he was only knocked down a few times in his career and always got up. But the end is not pretty for a man who was as fast with his mouth as he was with his fists.
No, it's not. And and we, you know, the lesson we derive from that is that he's human after all. And it's the toll that the sport that boxing has taken on him is the same toll that it took on Joe Frazier and many, many others. Oddly, in Liston's case, we should add that he died of a drug overdose in Las Vegas in 1970. There was some thought that the underworld was behind it in some way.
Hold that thought, and we shall return with Mark Cram, Jr., the author of like any normal day, and the son of Mark Cram Sr., the man who covered Muhammad Ali for 14 years for Sports Illustrated back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. Inkstershow at WRKF.org. J.C. Kane is producing, and a few more minutes with Mark Cram Jr., the author of Like Any Normal Day, and his father, like his son, a fabulous sports writer, and the man who covered Muhammad Ali for the definitive sports publication of his time, Sports Illustrated, during Ali's heyday, 63-77, and authored The Ghosts of Manila, the fateful blood feud between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, probably one of the top two or three. I don't think probably. It is one of the top two or three books ever written about Muhammad Ali. A question from a listener about the weigh-in in Miami on this day in 1964, February 25th. Some thought Ali had lost his mind, Mark. He put on quite a show at the weigh-in with Sonny Liston. What happened?
Well, again, he became hysterical, and it was sort of a scene that you didn't necessarily generally see at weigh-ins. Remember, back in the 50s and before Ali, weigh-ins were more or less kind of sedate affairs. There wasn't this sort of scene making that you saw, and to get back to my earlier point, I think Ali was truly afraid of Liston. I can't get around that. I think that Liston was bringing into the ring with him some very heavy credentials for ferocity, and I think that while humorous, I think that it really wasn't a really was an indication of just how, concerned and worried Ali was about this fight.
Sugar Ray Robinson thought Ali was terrified, that's why he was acting the way he was at the weigh-in.
Well, Sugar would have known, because he was very much in the inner circle at that time. Absolutely.
But how did Liston respond to it?
Well, Liston was as I say, worried about the Muslims that were lurking around. He said sense that, that there was some criminal intent around them, and he just didn't seem he seemed very wary. But insofar as Ali's concerned, there was not a doubt in his mind that he was going to, put a whooping on them. And not even that the fight was not even going to be close. He had no concern about Ali, none. He just didn't see. He thought he would land one of those haymakers, and that would be the end of it. You wouldn't hear from Ali again, and life would continue on for him as champion. Mm-hmm. But he badly estimated Ali. I think many of the experts, so-called experts at the time, underestimated him. They didn't really see beyond his showmanship and see what a tremendously fine and lethal athlete he was himself.
Well, your father covered Ali as a three-dimensional figure, and he was a man of immense talent, at times grace, charm, humor. But he also had a terrible mean streak, and your father was one of those who reported that. That was evidenced a few times along the way, wasn't it?
Well, it's true, but I would submit that his mean streak was no greater or less than any other human being, I think that Dad saw him, as you say, in three-dimensional terms, but which is unlike how Ali would become to be written, which is more or less this mythic figure without any shortcomings. So Ghost of Manila attempted to be honest. It was reviewed and critically received as a bit of a hatchet job on Ali, which I tend to reject, because I think that the writers that were highly critical of the book. Basically, Dad took them to task for not basically, you know, for mythologizing Ali. You know, Dad's point was, why isn't it enough that he was a great, great fighter, the greatest that ever lived? Why did, you know, Dad would hear some commentator or writer refer to Ali as the next to Martin Luther King, you know, Dad just didn't see the how the comparison fit in any way. You know, it was his view of it, and he was entitled to it because that was his life. Now, you're going to see a lot of books come out about Ali in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years that are going to be revisionist, and they're going to be written by people who weren't there. But Dad was there. He lived it. He was an intimate of Ali's over the years. They had many, many private conversations. And so Dad had he had the authority to write that book. To me, it will stand as a primary source for historians, you know, 50, 100 years from now when they look back on this era. They'll look at Ghost of Manila as a kind of a primary source that, you know, what this experience was, what this era was like. You know, I think the book will be around for a good while.
Well, we thank you for joining us today, Mark Cram, Jr. Always a pleasure, and look forward to talking with you again soon, Mark. And congratulations on your work being recognized appropriately as well.
Thank you so much, Jim. Have a pleasant day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. February 24th, 1964, Miami, Florida, 16 days after the Beatles arrived. And by the way, the Beatles had been in Miami prior to Muhammad Ali defeating Charles Sonny Liston in the seventh round, a 7-1 underdog, and the Ali legend began on this night a half century ago. Our guest now is Jason Berry, investigative reporter based in New Orleans, renowned for pioneering reporting on sexual abuse in the priesthood of the Catholic Church. His book, Lead Us Not Into Temptation, Catholic Priests and the Sexual Abuse of Children, was the first major book on the issue. He followed that with Vows of Silence. And he is back with a major frontline piece that airs tonight, Secrets of the Vatican. Good morning, Jason Berry.
Good morning, Jim. Nice to be with you.
Nice to talk with you, Jason. You're the co-producer of this frontline piece. How did it come about?
I was contacted last March, right about the time of the conclave, by one of the researchers on the production. Frontline had hired Anthony Thomas, who is a distinguished documentarian based in London, and a woman who was assisting in the research, had read my last book, Render Unto Rome, and we started communicating, actually, while I was covering the conclave at the Vatican. And one thing led to another, and then he got in touch with me a little bit later on in July. We began a long discussion about his vision of the film, and then soon after that I was hired.
Well, what is new? What ground is broken in the latest chapter of this story that continues to evolve?
I believe this film will give people a profound visual sense of what has transpired, because people who are often quoted in newspapers but not normally seen on screen really come alive in a sense. There's quite a range of footage, and the internal battles within the Roman Curia that led in many ways to the resignation of Pope Benedict are given in-depth treatment. You see the cardinals on the screen. You get a sense of who they are. And likewise with Pope Benedict, although many people have, you know, seen him on television or seen news footage, I think one gets visually a much clearer sense of why VatiLeaks happened, what the Vatican Bank scandal entails, and then some of the interviews with abuse victims are quite powerful and compelling.
Jason Berry is the producer, co-producer of tonight's Frontline piece, Secrets of the Vatican, and he has been on this story for well over two decades. How did you begin this voyage? It's been quite a journalistic odyssey for you covering this story, which I know you as a Catholic have a great passion about.
I've also got great pain about it, too. You can't be a Catholic and not have all that mixed in with the excitement that a journalist does experience covering a large story like this. I began digging in 1985. I did a series of articles for the Times of Acadiana and Lafayette and National Catholic Reporter, an independent weekly, on the prosecution and civil cases surrounding Gilbert Gothe, the priest in Lafayette. And that led to articles in other outlets, and I sort of followed that trail and published my first book on this topic in 1992. And every time I thought that I was pretty much done, I could be Cincinnatus and go back to the plow, I kept getting more information. A lot of people contact me often with leads and documents and things like that, and it just became a part of my life, even as I did other things, worked on other films, published a novel, did a music history. But I just kept getting drawn back into it. And the film that's airing tonight, in a sense, is an outgrowth of a lot of the work I did all over the years, although it is very much the work of the director, Anthony Thomas.
Well, it's a piece that I know you are proud of, and it covers this again, and I'm sure will open some new wounds. Are there still Catholics who are surprised at the stories that will be addressed in this piece?
I suspect so. I don't think many people really understand how the Vatican operates, whether they are Catholic or not. And the idea that the Roman Curia could be, like the Louisiana legislature during one of its, less pleasant sessions where people are feuding and fighting, or Mississippi or Georgia or, God knows, the Congress of the United States, I think is a bit of a surprise for people. They tend to think of the Vatican as this great religious castle in the sky, stately, noble, layered in secrets that we'll never learn. And in fact, the secrets have been spilling out almost like Watergate, a generation ago. And so, yeah, I think people who have either never gone to Rome or who are not well aware of how the church functions at that level will be enlightened. And there are certainly surprises in that sense, especially the latter part as it gets into the role of the butler leaking the documents and so forth.
Is the church doing a better job now of policing these priests?
Well, yes, but there are still terrific legal battles ongoing. I would say that the prospects today, chance today, that a bishop would knowingly recycle a priest who had abused a number of children, it's really remote. Most of the bishops, I think, severely understand that men who have this problem are possessed of a pathology with criminal implications, and you're really gambling with other people's lives to let someone like that maintain a position of pastorship or authority. Now, having said that, there are quite a number of people who've been abused in the past who are trying to get some form of legal redress, and that's why we focused on Milwaukee in the film, because Milwaukee Archdiocese chose bankruptcy rather than to negotiate settlements to many victims. And it's been a really sort of ruthless legal battle, and I think one gets a sense of that. And I can imagine if there are defense attorneys out there listening, they might question the use of the term ruthless, but I think when you watch this segment, one will realize that this is litigation by ordeal, and the people who've been sexually abused in the past are really waiting to get their day in court.
What's your take on Pope Francis?
Well, I'm very impressed with him, and I've written, I write a lot for Global Post, which is a foreign affairs website based in Boston, and I have been really intrigued by the way he has carefully put a circle of trusted cardinals from different parts of the world between himself and the Roman Curia, the bureaucracy of the church. You know, the Curia is nine departments, sort of like cabinet levels in Washington, if you will. And each one of those departments has a number of mid- and lower-level employees. And they sometimes get into turf wars. You know, if you follow politics in Washington, you know that the State Department is often in tension with the White House for a given policy. We sort of accept that as the push and pull of politics, but in a monarchical governing system, and the church is a monarchy, the Pope is the sovereign monarch, you need an absolute unity if the institution is going to function as it should. And there have been terrific infights and turf wars that sort of exploded in the leaking of all the documents by the butler a couple of years ago. And I think Francis has wisely managed to get control of the Vatican, or he's getting control of the Vatican Bank, by using three international consulting groups who are going in and checking, researching all of the account holders. I mean, the bank has functioned as a kind of offshore bank for certain privileged account holders, and the European oversight, a group called Moneyval, issued a report on the bank, and it has been under a sort of evolving status, I'd say, with oversight that Pope Benedict, to his credit, established, and Francis, I think, has strengthened. He's also promulgated a law that makes it a crime for anyone within the Vatican or employed by the Vatican to illegally transfer funds or to in any way engage in child abuse. And while that might seem like a sort of no-brainer, in a system that does not have a structure of laws that we do in the West, canon law is an administrative code, and what he's doing in a very deliberate sense is creating a mechanism with this law that sort of tracks Western jurisprudence. This is a first step, but I think it's an important one.
Secrets of the Vatican tonight on PBS, Frontline presentation. Jason Berry, the co-producer, will return with us, 297-5633 or 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Jason Berry. Secrets of the Vatican, a Frontline presentation co-produced by Jason, airs tonight on PBS. It's a special 90-minute episode by award-winning director Anthony Thomas, exploring the threats and scandals that challenged Benedict's papacy, a far-reaching sex abuse crisis, money laundering and corruption at the Vatican Bank, and VataLeaks, the release of internal documents revealing cronyism, power struggles, and allegations of blackmail within the Holy See. Jason Berry, has your faith in any way been shaken by all these revelations about your church?
Absolutely. I've had to do a lot of rethinking, soul-searching, I guess you'd say. It has not been an easy struggle, but if you look at the church historically, it has been a mirror of Western society with corruption and scandals going back through time. I do think spiritually, at least for me, and I'm not proselytizing, I'm just answering your question, it makes sense. There is a unity to the belief system that I am able to embrace. But as I say, it's not easy. I think some of the structural politics have been disastrous. But, you know, people go to church for personal reasons, for serenity, for fellowship, for solace. And most people really have very little connection to the Vatican or the Pope or what goes on. They hear about it. They read about it. But I think each of us has a sort of personal relationship with God. And I have fallen back on mine many times in sort of sustaining the spiritual odyssey that I've been on.
You've written about nuns in the church, including investigations of American nuns who were accused of radical feminism. The nuns are quite often forgotten people in the church.
Well, they are, and yet they continue to make news. And I must say that interviewing the various religious sisters for the series I did last year for Global Post and National Catholic Reporter, it was a joint assignment, I was both impressed and moved quite powerfully by the lives of witness that these women lead. And it was a power struggle between a large circle of cardinals in Rome, many of whom had dirty hands from the abuse crisis. Cardinal Law of Boston was the one who fomented the whole investigation. And, you know, he pretty much fled Boston in disgrace and managed to reestablish himself in Rome with a very nice mm-hmm. position, $10,000 a month salary. And, you know, as the archpriest, I think is the term, he's basically the pastor of a great basilica, Santa Maria Maggiore in Rome. And, you know, writing about what those sisters did in resisting that investigation was, to me, a great political story. So, yes, I have spent time with nuns. Some of my best friends are nuns.
Well, the time when we grew up in Louisiana, it was impossible for a Catholic to win a statewide race. Today, our governor is Catholic. Both U.S. senators are Catholic. And they, if you look at Governor Jindal and Senators Landrieu and Vitter, I would imagine all three of them have different spiritual backgrounds.
Well, they do. I'm not sure Mary Landrieu still considers herself a Catholic. I may be wrong on this, but I remember reading one of the candidate bios which said that she worshipped at, I believe, the Episcopal Cathedral in Washington, D.C. I'm not trying to inject a political issue into our discussion, but, you know, when Archbishop Hughes of New Orleans attacked her for her position on abortion, it backfired in a political sense. I think it a lot of people felt much more supportive and sympathetic toward her for, you know, standing her ground. But I believe she joined another congregation after that, at least from what I recall reading in the Picayune. You know, the interesting thing about the church is that it is a big tent, and it reflects the American map. It's almost like a blue church and a red church underneath the same big tent. So you've got conservative Republicans like Jindal and Vitter who take heart, church's conservative dogmatic positions. And then you've got, you know, people who are left of center who see in the commitment to the poor, the work of anti-war activists, or the work of those liberal nuns as, you know, authenticating the faith that they have. So it is an institution that is different things to many people.
Well, tonight, Frontline's presentation by Jason Berry and award-winning director Anthony Thomas will explore the Catholic Church, warts and all, and it is Secrets of the Vatican. We look forward to seeing it, and it's always good to talk with you, Jason.
Jim, it is always a pleasure to have dialogue with you as well.
Well, congratulations on another fine work from you, and let's keep in touch. See you soon.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay.
297-5633 is your number, 877-217-5757. And Susan Rowan is our guest, American author. She's written several business networking self-help books, including How to Work a Room, number one bestseller in 1990. And it's back for a major anniversary, the silver anniversary. Good morning, Susan.
Well, good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, why was it necessary to revise a number one bestseller from a quarter century ago?
Well, this is actually the fourth revision, and to be honest, the last one that I wrote in 2006, it's not that people have changed, but technology has changed. And unfortunately or fortunately, it's changed the way we behave. And we needed, to be honest, I needed to get some of the old words out of there so that people reading it would go, what? A pager?
One of the words you use is schmoozing. Is it important for us to schmooze when we're working a room?
You know, let me just tell you what schmooze really means. Schmooze is a word that means easygoing, friendly conversation. Unfortunately, it's been co-opted and given a pejorative meaning. But you want to just be a person who can schmooze, chat, talk to people. And here's the key for all our listeners, so that they're comfortable with you.
Mm-hmm. Who does it better, men or women?
Well, I mean, that's a slippery slope. I think we talk about different things. The one thing I always advise since How to Work a Room first came out 25 years ago is that women ought to read the sports page. And by the way, in one speech that I did, in fact, I've even spoken in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, I had the audience groan when I said that women should read the sports page. And my comment was, if the other 50% of the population's reading it, why wouldn't you?
Susan Rowan is our guest. Her book is How to Work a Room, now in its fourth revision, number one bestseller 25 years ago. And when you walk in a room, we've had Eli Jones, a former dean of the LSU Business School, on. He says people generally make an impression about you in the first 6 to 8 seconds.
And that's, we do that because we look at your clothes, we look at, but what a dumb thing to do. Because here's the part that goes to networking rather than just working a room. Honestly, Jim, in 6 seconds, do you know who I'm related to? Do you know who I know? Do you know who knows me? So if you don't like the way I'm dressed or the color of my lipstick or what the kind of shoes I'm wearing or that I might laugh a little more heartily, you preclude yourself from being part of my network that might introduce you to other parts of the network that you never would have assumed I had. So we do make these fast impressions, and they're often wrong.
But there are some things we can control about how we dress and how we look. And,
absolutely.
And those quite often are important.
You know what? If you're invited to an event that's business, you don't show up in Friday casual. You know, I was asked to speak, and I can't say which university, to the law school. And the gentleman from the Career Center said to me, in your presentation, would you please tell them not to go to the event we're having in flip-flops. So, yes, we can control things. We should look right. We should dress for the occasion. We should be well-groomed. All of that is true. But I once went to an event, and everyone was in a navy blue suit. I think there was probably a sale on them back in the days of the Big Eight. And one guy was wearing a powder blue kind of alpaca sweater, and I said to the managing partner, oh, look at him. And I got upbraided, and that's one of the things I share in the book. He said to me, Susan, don't you judge him. He is worth millions of dollars. He's not a client. We'd like him to be. He doesn't have to dress for success. because he is one. So I got my lesson really handed to me.
What are some icebreakers that we should be cognizant of when we walk in a room?
When we walk in a room, first of all, before we even walk in a room, please prepare. A, know how you're going to introduce yourself, because really there's going to be no one there to take you around and introduce you to people generally. So have your own planned self-introduction prepared. And this is the Roanne rule, 7 to 9 seconds, keyed to the event, to help people figure out why you're there and give them context for conversation. The other thing we should do is prepare some conversation, but there's so much to talk about. You've walked into a room. Maybe you've driven there, taken public transportation. It's small talk, but how long did it take you to get there? Did you find parking? Have you been to this venue before? Are you a member of this organization? And it doesn't matter if it's the Chamber, the Rotary, a charity. How about talking about the food? I love talking about food.
Are there some don'ts as far as introductions? And like if I were to be introduced to you and say, what's your sign?
You know what I always used to say?
What?
Dollar.
That's a good one. I like that.
I live here in like California in Marin County, and there was a time when people asked that. I still have friends that go into a whole litany of things because they're one or the other sign, and I look at them and say, I have no idea what you're talking about. But I couldn't help but say dollar sign. You know, that was something. But you know, another thing people say they try to resist is asking people, what do you do? Because sometimes people have avocations more important than what their job is. So here's another way to ask them, hey, what do you do in your spare time?
There
you can
go.
Find out who's the mountain climber, who the fly fisherman is, who the person who works for the local, you know, breast cancer foundation in their spare time.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are ways to kill a conversation. People may be married to a spouse for a long time or at the same job for a long period, and if you ask, are you still working there, that has a negative connotation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Either way, what if they're not and they just been laid off or, what did they say, de-employed? And what if the marriage, whatever, I think, are you still... implies, well, it is pejorative. It is a connotation. Mm-hmm. So I think saying it another way is, oh, what are you doing now? How's life? How's the there are other ways to ask questions and say things than, you know, that still means what a drag.
Susan Roanne is the guest. Her book is How to Work a Room. Many people are shy who otherwise might not be shy, but when they walk into a room of strangers, it's a bit intimidating. How can people overcome this, and why are they shy in that kind of environment?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because according to research, when I first wrote this book 25 years ago, the research out at the Stanford Shyness Clinic was that 80% of American adults self-identified as shy in one instance or another. Not everyone was shy all the time, but, you know, I'm even shy at certain events when I walk in by myself and don't know anyone. Sometimes I have to say to myself, oh, my gosh, what did I write on page 34? But once the book came out again in 2000, do you know that statistic jumped to 93%? Why is that important? Every time any one of our listeners walks into a room, you should know that at least 90% of the room feels uncomfortable, a little shy, a little daunted as well. So that can even start a conversation. But how we can overcome it? Again, prepare. Have your own self-introduction. Listen to the radio, watch TV. Know what's mm-hmm. in your newspaper. If you read a national and a local paper, you'll be prepared with all the conversation you could possibly have, whether it's about local politics or sports. My goodness, we just finished the Olympics. Someone asked me what my favorite was, and I said the Bolshoi Ballet and the opening and closing ceremonies. But it started a conversation.
What about names? When we're in a large group, we might meet 25 people, and it's sometimes hard to remember the names of so many people thrown at one at a given time.
You know what? Most of us, and I know this is true, have forgotten significant names of people. We'll place their face, and we can't retrieve the name. What you can do to remember better is really when you're talking to someone, focus on, if they have a name tag, look at the written word, look at their face, repeat their name, because then you're engaging more senses.
Nicholas on Nicholson writes, when going out and wondering if whether to overdress or underdress, always overdress. Do you agree with that, Susan?
Yeah, I. You know what? Because you can't be criticized for wearing flip-flops if other people are just wearing, you know, wingtip shoes. I think he's right. You be dressed appropriately, a little overdressed. Underdressed will have you be noticed, but for the wrong reason. I agree with him.
Well, thank you, Susan. The book, How to Work a Room. Good to visit with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we'll be back tomorrow. Until then, thank you for listening and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.